This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the Tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Mike Summerfield, an ecumenical chaplain at the Otago University. He also has a Master of Science and has worked in science laboratories here and in UK. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and then going to Community or Chaos. Mike, welcome to Community or Chaos.
Morena, thank you for having me here.
What motivated you to become a campus chaplain?
I love university. I love that there is a place where anything can be studied. I think that's the universal in the university. I mean, within the constraints of academic framework and if you can find funding, there's this idea that you can look into anything. And I love that everything that is investigated is done in conversation with everything else that's investigated. So genetics has something to say to gender studies, and biology has something to say to theology. So I wanted to be one of those voices. I wanted faith to be part of that conversation, to be one of those counterparts.
Well, I'm going to ask you something off the cuff. What does genetics say to gender study?
It's nuanced, I think, is what both would say. So there is the biology of the phenotype of a person, how they are, how they're put together, and then there is the how they live that out in the world, and that needs to be a conversation. You can't have one saying one thing and not having a counterpart.
When I was young, I was told that gender was on a line, a place in that most of us had aspects of both femininity and masculinity that we inherited. Would that still be true?
Well, gender is the word we put on the construct of, you know, how we see a person and how they conform to societal roles. And gender is complex all over the world. And I think what works on a population level seldom works on an individual level. So you can look at a great number of, you know, representations of any given thing. Once you drill down to the level of an individual, the data means much, much less. So we are who we are. We are how we're made. We are how we live, and collectively we're sort of part of these constructs.
But even in those days, science recognized it was complicated.
Yeah.
So could you talk about hope? Because I think hope is one of those things that it is even at least as complicated as gender.
Yeah. Hope is our expression that we are not in control. So there's the world around us. There's things we don't need to hope for, things that we just get up off the couch and do. And then there's things that are beyond our control. And so they're in the realm of, I want that to happen, but I can't control that happening. So the feeling that I have towards that is one of hope. And what you base that on is different in different situations. But I think, there's that sense that you live in the expectation that good things can happen, and you live in such a way that you're ready for them when they do, and that you're looking for them when they don't happen.
If it's something to do with society, do you need to make an effort to enable those hopes to come true, even knowing you may fail totally?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have small hopes. So we have the hopes like, I hope tomorrow is a nice day, or I hope that I get the weekend off. And those are the places where we are able to work. So there's no point saying, I hope I'm on time for work and not setting an alarm. Hope won't prevail in that case. So we know that we must work towards making the hope happen, but we understand that, you know, we may not succeed because it is beyond our control.
When I lived in a small town a long time ago, I had a friend, a workmate, who used to pray for parking, places to park.
Mm-hmm.
And even then I sort of laughed at that, because if you couldn't find a parking place in this town, why, you need to go to your eye doctor. But so to me, hope is something, or even prayer is something for either for your own good, to be the kind of person you hope to be, or for something that isn't necessarily certain.
Yeah, so I think alongside small hopes, we have sort of this realm of big hope, where it's nearly existential at that point. You know, you sort of ask yourself, is there a point to all of this? Will justice prevail? Is there a point to the life that I'm living? And prayer for a parking space is more than just, I want a parking space. It's also that I want my life to have meaning. I want to know that I'm going through this life, you know, in the hands of the Almighty, that relational sense to, if I pray for a parking space, then we may rejoice together when we find a parking space. And it's a bigger story than I need a parking space. It's more of I need my life to have purpose.
I guess that makes sense. I never thought of it that way. Though it annoys me when people pray to become rich.
Right.
And become rich and then think they're better people because they deserve the wealth. That God's somehow saying they're better than other people because they became rich.
Yeah, there is an interesting thing when you read the Bible. If you read a book like the start of Romans, where you see Paul pointing out the way that the world is and saying, when you wish for bad things, sometimes God says, okay, you may have that. And I think I would put wealth in that category. It's not a safe thing to have. I can't imagine theologically that I could say it was a seal of approval from God that you gained wealth.
I guess that's one place where even if you're not a Christian, having some sense of the teachings of Jesus may play a part. Because he didn't advocate wealth necessarily. In fact, he advocated looking after your neighbor, if I understand it. And your neighbor may not be wealthy. They may be wealthy. And everybody has needs.
Yes, yeah.
And some of them are material needs and some of them are social. And of course, they're connected.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've often thought about being wealthy, and I've noticed that every time I think about wealth, it's in the context of I want to be in control of my life. So wealth is a means to autonomy in our minds. It allows us to do the things we want to do. So in other words, it's a hope that I have the power of realizing when I'm wealthy. Whereas I think the teachings of the Bible make the most sense to those who have the least control. So those who are crying out for someone to advocate for them, someone to walk beside them, someone to provide for them. That's the hope, the big hope, that the Lord will will be the one who does that. Whereas wealth lets me bypass that. It lets me buy nice things. And
yes. When I've been Walter Minty, you ever heard of Walter?
Mm-hmm.
He was the short stories about somebody who dreamed about a different life.
Mm.
And anyway, I wanted wealth so I could advocate, maybe fund a political party on the left.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Fortunately, I've never had that temptation come true.
Yeah.
Of course, I knew that. I mean, I've never prayed for such a thing. That would be obscene. But we often want things that we can't have.
Yeah.
How do you differentiate different kinds of hopes, the strands of hopes?
I think there's probably no firm distinction between them. They're just a sense of scale and the importance that we feel. So I hope that my life is meaningful. It means that I also hope that the conversation this morning is productive. I hope that there is justice for all people in the end. It means that I hope that I'm able to act justly and to love mercy and to treat people with dignity and respect when I find them. So I think the hope that is the guiding principle also shapes the hopes that we have day to day.
I guess everybody has times of personal difficulty when hope seems distant. However, I'm concerned that hope in the larger world, and more particularly in New Zealand. And what are some of the things in this world and at home in New Zealand that might drive young people to despair?
I think young people are perpetually in a place of waiting for old people to hand over power and agency. So I think you remember when you were young, looking at those who were making decisions on your behalf and for your future, and thinking there's nothing I can do until such time as they're gone, and then I will be the one who will be able to make some of those decisions. So I think it's an age-old issue. The hope of the young is that things aren't too bad when they are able to take over doing things.
It's one of the things that you may realize when you're young, is that the things that happen to you when you're young actually can predict to a high extent what your future will be, what things that happen to you and to society itself.
Mm.
Do you think it's difficult for young people?
I do, yeah. So, I mean, there are big button issues that you see all over the place. So climate change, I think, is the biggest issue that faces young people at the moment, simply because they're moving into that future. And, you know, the ones that come after them, their immediate family that they care about, are moving into the future beyond that. And there is so little that you can do to change the way the world behaves. So you can, it's one of those hopes where you have to admit, I cannot change the way other people behave.
I was talking to my son about this. He lives in Wellington and works in an office with a number of people, a fairly small team. And he says one of his friends goes on climate strikes every weekend. Slightly younger than him, but I think he sympathizes with it. But we were talking about it.
Mm.
It's hard to talk about climate change to your family because it's going to be difficult.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's easier to talk to your younger family about it than your older family, I find. But yeah, so our children also went on climate strikes. I was there with them on a few of those. I insisted that we either walked or took public transport to get there. There was no way that you could sign out of school for a climate strike and have the convenience of dad take you in the car. So there was – what I was hoping in those things is that you want to ground your hope in something. So you don't want to despair that the world is going to die, because I don't think it will. You don't want to despair that it won't be worth living through, because I think it will be. So you do want something to get on with. And, you know, walking to the Octagon is an immediate thing that you can do. Accepting that we're probably not going to travel by jet if we can avoid it is an immediate thing that you can do. Writing a letter to the climate change minister is an immediate thing that you can do. It won't make no difference, and it won't make a large difference. But it's just trying to find the practical outworking of the big hope that you have.
Do you think government has a responsibility to climate change?
Absolutely.
I was thinking, we talk about not taking jets. One of the things I feel bad about, and I think my family does too, is it's very difficult to go to Wellington without flying.
Yes.
They used to have a train.
Mm.
And we're not even going to have a roll-on ferry for freight shortly.
Yeah.
So does having a government that governs in the interest of ordinary people, common people, is that important to people's hopes and their attitude toward the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Government's problem always is short-term reward versus long-term reward. And you need to be speaking a message of hope if you want to sell long-term solutions. So it's the cycle of news, the cycle of elections, the cycle of people's memories. It makes it very difficult if you don't kind of have a national narrative about the common good, about how we honour people, how we are but one generation in all that's come before and all that will come after, how the land endured before we were here and how it will endure after we've gone. If there isn't that telling of that big story, then it's very difficult to convince people to pay the price for the long-term solutions. Rather, people hope that this weekend will be good and that, you know, they can get the nice bottle of wine or whatever the small hopes are that we have. And it's very easy to speak to those.
This is why people that are my age or even just a little younger remember, even though they weren't there, they know the generation that went through it. Michael Joseph Savage, who said that socialism was practical Christianity.
Yes, yeah.
But is that why they remember the first labor government? Because they had a vision and tried to carry it out?
Yeah, absolutely, and because it had a context. So, you've got the horror of the Great War and the Great Depression. You've got some sense collectively that the way that we were governed did not do well by us. Empire led to the death of millions, and unrestrained capitalism led to the suffering of billions. And so there is that context where someone comes along and says, we've been prioritizing the wrong things. So the wrong people have been front and center, and we want to prioritize everybody rather than just a few. He had the social capital, I think, at that time to be able to implement that. So people were not wanting to go backwards. They were hopeful of going forwards.
I remember, I was born and raised in the United States, you might gather from my accent. But I remember when I came here, I was a some friends of mine who lived in Auckland said, you should really, if you're unhappy about America and its trajectory, you should come to New Zealand, where a socialist paradise.
Mm.
And it felt like that in the 70s.
Mm.
And people, I don't remember people complaining about paying taxes.
Mm.
But all of a sudden in the 80s, it became, taxation became evil. Mm. Why? Why do people buy that?
Yeah, I think about this a bit, actually. So I think about when I was 9 years old, my father was killed in an accident. And there was a widow's benefit, and there was a widow's and orphan's club, and there was all manner of social support for, you know, our family, which meant my mother didn't have to work. She was able to stay in her own home with us, and, you know, life was good, and we felt like people were taking care of us. The flip side of that was there was very few kinds of car you could buy. There was very few kinds of washing machines you could buy. There was very few kinds of televisions you could buy and very little you could watch on it. So there was a constraint nationally which allowed money to be funneled towards the things that the government wanted.
Don't you always have constraints?
There are
different kinds of constraints. Like if you can't afford a car, that's a constraint.
Indeed. But, I mean, we do have to admit that since the 80s, we have far more buying power, far more freedom to consume, far more freedom to have the things that we want. But the constraint there is we are less generous. We're far less likely to want people to have more than they've got. So I think, we were tired of those constraints, and I don't think we realized the price in giving them up.
It seems to me that we just change constraints. And also with some constraints, some people have a lot more constraints than others.
Indeed, yeah. So I think freedom and equality have an inverse relationship. So the more equality you want, the less freedom you can allow, in a sense. And I think we were sold freedom, but we weren't. Mm-hmm. We didn't buy into the cost of inequality, which is what we're seeing now. So you're right. There's far less constraints for some than for others.
I grew up in a society that talked a lot about freedom, but a lot of people didn't have that freedom. I grew up in a family where, at the end of the payday, I mean, at the end of the month, you worried about paying for your groceries, the food you ate.
Mm.
And we were free to do anything we could afford to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
And so I think that, you know, having sufficiency can be freeing if you know you're going to have that sufficiency.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. So, I mean, the freedom that I was talking about, it unfortunately overlaps. So the freedom for one person to be a billionaire impinges on the freedom of everybody else to be rich. So it simply isn't possible for equal freedom to lead to equal outcomes. So someone who follows socialism yourself, you'll understand you need to put restrictions on where that money can rest.
Also, I wonder if it turned out the freedom consumers turned out to be good for the planet, good for the world we live in and depend on. You may argue whether you're dependent on God or not, but you can't argue whether you depend on the earth or not.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, there is a cost, and we haven't been paying it. So we've dug up the resources and we've dumped the waste, and we have consumed things in the middle with no regard to will there still be resources or what will the cost of the dumping be.
Does the Enlightenment theory on automatic movement of the world toward progress still make sense in the first half of the 21st century in the light of recent experience?
Yeah, the Enlightenment is fascinating. So it was one of those times of big hopes, even though they probably wouldn't have framed it in that language. So they are interested in the telos, in the end of all things, and how we might understand them and move there. So I think I agree that we do progress. So in the sense that knowledge gained is knowledge kept by the world. So even if we do something wrong, we know that we've done that wrong. That still adds to the knowledge that we've got from those who came before, that we can pass on to those who come after. Whether we pay attention to that knowledge is a different topic. So I think the world does progress in the sense that we gain in knowledge, but I think the pendulum swings back and forth as we pay attention to one thing and then pay attention to a different thing.
You know, sometimes I think of life as more of a spiral than a straight line. Well, I'm going to play a song now, and then we'll come back.
Okay.
Well, we're talking with Mike Summerfield, a campus chaplain, about hope, and we just listened to Leonard Cohen, Love Itself. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz, then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Now, do we need a ground of hope to see our being in hopeful ground that's beyond what's happening to us immediately? Our Martin Luther King, even though he expected to be killed, said there is the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends toward justice. And he continued to have hope even when things weren't going well.
Mm.
And one of my heroines of spirituality was Etty Hilson. She was a Jewish woman in Holland, and she was waiting to be taken in Ravensbrück to be taken to Auschwitz. And she talked about her hope in God. Not the God that could save her. She said, God, somehow you can't help us, but we must help you. Keep you inside ourselves. Do we need something that's more essential than, I mean, I hope for social justice. I try at times to work for it, and I hope for peace. But do I need a hope that's beyond that?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we talk about that hope?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I am by nature of being in a ministry position, I think when Martin Luther King says the arc of the moral universe is long, I agree. But I think it might be a sine wave, this arc. It has its ups and downs, even though it is a long arc itself. And different people find themselves in different situations in the world. And you've mentioned a couple who are at very low points where almost all of their autonomy is gone. And there's nothing they can do for themselves, but they still hope that beyond them, after them, there will be good. And so I think, the hope comes from those places where sufficient hurt causes us to rethink how we live together. So the hope of those who were on their way to Auschwitz was somewhat realized in post-war Europe, where people learned from the horror that we cannot do that again. We must do things differently. And it wasn't the good that got them there. It was the realization of how desperately bad we can be. And so I think even, or especially, in the bottom of the sine wave, the down periods. People are looking for that longer arc. And I think from a Christian standpoint, that has to be true in the way that we think. So the arc is under God's control. And whether God leaves us to discover the end of the rainbow for ourselves, whether we're allowed sufficient time to, you know, do everything well and everything badly until such time as we see the whole truth, or whether God steps in and says, you know, today this ends and I will intervene. I always have hope that the arc is, you know, the expression of Dr. King is true, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
I guess it's one of the things that has saddened me is that my parents lived through fascism. Mm. And my mother's grandfather was Jewish. And my parents, in America, the left looked to Europe, not to Great Britain. Mm. And so what happened there? And I thought we were vaccinated, you know. I thought until recently, I thought we were vaccinated against fascism or against genocide.
Mm.
But it turned out not to be the case.
Mm.
The vaccination, like the willingness to pay taxes wears off.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We have short collective memories sometimes, I think.
Maybe that's my curse. I have a long collective memory.
But you're
don't
right,
Christians
you know,
need to have a long collective memory?
Oh, absolutely. We need to be formed by the story of God's world and God's part in that world in which we live for a time. So there is a sense that we ought to learn, and we ought to hold what we've learned up to what we see happening, and we ought to understand what the times are, and we ought to be able to speak into them for, you know, to say this is right and this is wrong.
How do you share this with people who may reject Christianity, in fact, religion, totally, because of their experience? I suspect that popular American Christianity hasn't done for much for young intellectuals.
Yeah. We're having a discussion, a group of Christian leaders, last week about TikTok and the way that it presents tradition, and just concluded that it doesn't go wide enough. So, you know, you talk about a traditional thing, that's going to be limited to a time and to a place. So the traditional experience of Christianity in America right now is not the same as the experience of Christianity 400 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. So well, it's not the experience of Christianity in a, you know, a country like Kazakhstan or in China or North Korea. So we need, when we're understanding the story, to have the whole story, to have the big story. We need to. So I think
Both evangelicals and skeptics forget, for instance, that one of the first groups of people in Great Britain to oppose slavery and actually turned the British government around on the slave trade were evangelical Christians and Quakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But who remembers that?
Yeah. I mean, the Quaker story there is brilliant in the sense that nonconformists lost freedom, so they weren't allowed to participate in all manner of things. So it gave them time and it gave them energy to challenge those things that they weren't allowed to participate in. So they could challenge the military might of the empire. They could challenge the selfishness of the government and the way that it treated people. So I think, yeah, in that sense, from the bottom of the sine wave, when you have less autonomy, people start to see what is the true hope that we can be aiming for, and is it summed up in trinkets? Is it summed up in material comfort? Or is there a space here where we can speak truth to power?
Well, I'm going to play a little bit of Juliana Norwich because I like her. So I may not finish her song, but here we go. Well, that was Juliana Norwich. And she lived in the Middle Ages during the Black Plague, when half of Britain and Europe died of the plague. And she wrote that, well, she said those words. Mm. At that time, she was living in a monistic situation, and she was a mystic.
Mm.
When you talk about climate change or global warming, should we publicly downplay global warming in order to avoid depressing the public, or should we be truthful?
We have to be truthful. False hope is a terrible thing to sell anyone, I think, or ill-informed hope. I think, for the last 30 years, the science has been unequivocal. This is changing, and its changes are going to be significant. And it is a man-made issue. I think, it's a bit of a litmus test on whether we can work together towards a good hope, whether we can, as a nation, think long-term, as a globe, think long-term about what we hope for, not just for ourselves, but for generations to come, and whether we can pay the price now in terms of, us having less or us being inconvenienced in order that it can go well for people in the future. But I think we have to be honest and tell the truth in these things.
How do you approach younger people about hope?
I think people are naturally hopeful. You wouldn't get out of bed otherwise. You need, this desire that the what is unknown might be good, is worth pursuing. So, young people, whether they're religious, whether they're secular, they have the same amount of hope, but it's placed in different places. And I also tend to think, when you look at the expanse of history, there is as much to be hopeful about now as there ever has been, and there's as much to despair of now as there ever has been. They're just different specific things. So I don't know that we're in a too different a place to say Julian of Norwich, where you see what is around you and you look for what you want to be and you find signs of hope that you're moving that way and you'll find signs of despair that you're not. I would want to talk to young people about what they are hoping in, what they are despairing about.
I guess maybe in the Middle Ages people didn't feel as autonomous.
Mm.
That now we denote to a large extent the outcomes are dependent on our action. That, if I don't know what God is, this is another discussion. I think one of the things that the Jews or Christians need to think about is how you talk about God. Mm. One of the ideas of Judaism was the God that you can describe or name is an idol.
Mm.
Meister Eckhart, a medieval Christian theologian, said the same thing. But maybe that gives us the freedom to find going beyond God the King, God the Dominator, to Spirit, maybe God the Breath, God the Wind, the Mother Hen, the Sophie of the wisdom of that's available to humanity through nature, through the spirit, through our experience.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I have no idea who's quoted it, but somewhere once I read, on the sixth day, God created man, and on the seventh day, man returned the favor. There is that perpetual danger that we as the creation want to define who the creator is. And I think when you talk about the king, that is a model of understanding the divine, but we find aspects of it very, very helpful to pushing our will and our way of doing things onto others. But like I would say about all things, there's no, we scrabble to understand who God is, how God is, what God is. Leonard Cohen is someone who did that very publicly. You have to have as much of the picture as you can get. So it isn't enough to settle on a view of God that's useful to you. That I think is a false hope. It is better to explore broadly and critique deeply all of the shortcomings of the different views that we have, to understand God who is creator and sustainer and giver of life, God who is mysteriously absent and mysteriously present, God who promises, as Julian of Norwich said, that all will be well, and yet seems not to be in these places where things aren't going well.
It seems to me that sometimes God may often be present where we're not present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the hope of there being a God, of that God caring and being able to change our circumstance, belongs to those with the least autonomy. And if we're not seeing that hope, I suspect it's because we're able to do things for ourselves without reference to God. So for us, if we're in that place, then that hope becomes a discipline. How do I deliberately shape my life that I may live with regard to God? Whereas somebody who's got no autonomy, for them it's a way of life. They have nothing but hope.
One of the things I've often thought and experienced, actually, is that working class people have less choices, less autonomy than people who either were born into the upper middle class or grow into it through university and the like. They can often, I think this is changing, but until recently they could choose their jobs, choose their careers. They could choose their lifestyle. Now, once they made that choice, they might not be able to come back, but they had more choices than many people have.
Yeah, freedom and restrictions is interesting on that. We've got friends who work in a slum in Thailand. We took our children and visited them once. And there is no freedom in that slum for many people. They simply can't leave it. Sometimes even physically, taxis refuse to drive in there. But within the context, within the framework of living there, there was immense freedom. So everybody did a thing that helped them to survive, and you could do that thing and live. And I just remembered coming back to New Zealand and thinking, if I wanted to open a coffee shop on my front lawn, I would not have the freedom to do that because a coffee shop has to be in a place where coffee shops are. So I had the freedom to go to a slum and leave, the freedom to go to a country and come back. But I don't have the freedom to make pancakes in my bedroom and sell them out the window. I think we always restricted by the way we make our society run.
Do you think we can make better decisions and live through life if we feel like the ground of our life is grounded in something hopeful and loving?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So if you've got something worth living for, whether it's, you know, your hope in the end times, whether it's your hope in your community, your hope in your family, then it is much easier to make decisions, especially costly ones, that you're able to have an embodied hope, I would call that, where you live out day to day the hope that you have.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
No, I think I've said all I have to say.
Okay, thanks a lot. And hope to see you again, maybe over the radio.
Okay.
Mike.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.